physics of quarks to the physics of banjos. This is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, April 30th, 2015. I'm Jim Carrier. Tonight, we have a very special show for a couple of reasons. First, the Perpetual Notion Machine, Madison's only regularly produced radio science show, has received an upgrade here at WORT. Starting tonight, we will be a regular weekly Thursday evening fixture. That's right, every Thursday at 7 p.m., the Perpetual Notion Machine will air a 30-minute show of science, news, research, book reviews, controversies, and interviews on a wide range of topics. In a town where science rules, that's very good news for us, the brain trust that we tap for our programs, and for listeners who like science. The second reason is that we are privileged to kick off this new schedule with a Nobel laureate. But it's not about his work in physics. It's about the banjo. Yes, the banjo, America's quintessential original instrument, the butt of jokes, stereotypes, and a rich cultural history brought to us by slaves, adapted by black-faced minstrels, and now a ubiquitous sound in folk, country, and even rock music. Tonight we tackle the age-old question of what makes the banjo sound like a banjo. Our guest is David Politzer, a professor of theoretical physics at the California Institute of Technology. In 1973, as a graduate student at Harvard University, Politzer happened upon what he calls
a final piece in the puzzle of what we call the strong interactions, the forces between quarks, the things that are inside protons and neutrons, and how it surprisingly depends on distance, which is to say it doesn't get weaker as the quarks get further and further apart. So as they try to get far apart, something has to happen.
Very simply, quarks actually become bound more tightly the farther they get from each other. Think of a rubber band which increases in tightness as it is stretched. Well, so much for the fundamental forces of the universe. Let's get to the important stuff, like banjos. As a teenager in the 1960s, Politzer and most of his friends were into folk music, playing guitars and banjos.
I was still in hock paying off my first guitar, which I still have, a good one, and my first 10-speed bicycle. So those were major purchases for me. But banjo, I thought, I really want. So the real only realistic alternative was to build one. So age 15, I built a banjo from scratch. And I still remember to this day the first time stringing it up. Because unlike other stringed instruments where they're like really good ones and they're really lousy ones, banjos, as long as, you know, the strings hold their tension and the frets are in the right place, the bridge is in the right place, it sounds like a banjo. I've never met a banjo that I didn't love.
Now, I must ask, how many banjos do you own?
No, that's like asking a woman how old she is or how many Hawaiian shirts I own. I own more than my share. The excuse used to be that I would only buy one if it really had a different voice, because I became quite intrigued by that's a physics issue for me. And even if you're not a physicist, it's kind of interesting. They sound different. And the question is for me, it's a question of how and why. For people who just enjoy banjos, maybe they just enjoy the fact that they sound different. I like listening and looking for that.
As it turns out, Caltech, where Politzer is a professor, was looking for out-of-ordinary freshman seminars that might be fun, a break from the serious grind of math and engineering. So as students did their projects, he decided to do a project of his own, a look at the physics of the banjo. As it turns out, the Deering Company, also in California, made a $400 model called the Good Time.
And I thought, I have a small research budget at Caltech, sort of comes with my whatever. And I went to the chairman of my department and said, could I use that for buying banjos if that's what I'm working on? And he looked at me and he said, well, Yes.
So now, David Politzer, who won the Nobel in 2004, has been studying, just for fun, the physics of his banjos. I ask him to start with a fundamental question. Just what is a banjo?
Well, good question. I can say a few things, but one of the fascinating things, and I'll get back to it in a second, but fascinating thing about the acoustics of musical instruments, which is a subject that attracted Pythagoras. I don't know the intervening years, but one of my physics heroes, Helmholtz, early, mid-19th century, figured out what's going on with violin bows, very serious physicist. But if you want to, or if you get attracted to the acoustics of musical instruments, you have to make contact with music, which is a very human thing. And there's so many things that we do without knowing the particulars. We recognize other people, we recognize voices, we recognize instruments. And to actually say, what is it in the sound record that we're seizing on to make that identification? That's really hard to do. So the simple things about banjos, unplugged as acoustic instruments, they are loud. There are very few people who bow banjos. Needless to say, they exist, okay? But if you pluck a banjo, the initial sound is loud, and part of that is that it's then necessarily very short, because the energy that you put into the vibrating string comes out quickly, and that's what we mean by loud. And so it has a very short sustain. It's a very short note, and it's loud. Very short note means, unless you play another note pretty soon, it's a dead time. Dead time, a little dead time is good. But banjo playing tends to be a very rapid succession of notes, because they don't hang there the way guitar notes do. So they're loud, they're short. Oh, and then here's the one that I love, because we don't know what this means. Banjos ring. Stephen Foster, okay, wrote songs that featured banjos. There was a song, the title was Ring, Ring the Banjo, or the phrase banjos ringing as lyrics in other songs. And he wrote before the Civil War, 1840s, banjos had no metal parts. They were ringing. And I think that's a right, that's one way to describe it in words. Another I remember from an interview with Pete Seeger, and he was quite old at the time. And he then says, because someone asked him about what's special about the banjo, these little points of sound, and lots of them, okay? But in that whole sort of sea, it's like stars in the sky, little points of sound, you can still pick out the melody. Mm-hmm. And he thought that was quite magical. And I can't do better.
Well, let's go back to the elements that make up the sound, or the physics of the sound. You have the strings, you have a head, the drum head.
Well, that's the common aspect. There's one thing that it dawned on me because it was so confusing, and that's to connect the strings to the drum head. You do it in a particular way. All banjos do it in really pretty much the same way. You have the bridge, thin piece of wood, thin on purpose, not thick, tucked between the strings and the drum head. And the strings make it go up and down, and it makes the drum head go up and down. It's called a floating bridge, and the strings don't anchor on the bridge or right near it. They kind of go over it and are anchored at the far end of the drum. So that's a floating bridge, and that's part of the common design in banjos in ancient Egypt, banjos in Japan, China, Tibet, Mongolia, going back at least several hundred years, banjos coming to the Western Hemisphere from Africa. They all had this floating bridge where the string goes over the bridge, anchored at the far end, because you don't drill holes in the drum head. It's to attach the strings.
Right.
Okay. So that's part of basic design, and I got this vision that maybe that's part of the key. I don't know if it is, but at least it's an idea.
Let's break this down a little bit. I mean,
okay.
we got this bridge that's floating on top of the drum head, and then you've got the what you call the break angle, which is how the strings end themselves at a tailpiece. And you've written papers about how those two elements create a harmonics or basically a synthesizer in a way, a modulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Explain that a little bit.
Okay. Well, when you study physics and strings and turn it into equations, which we do, where do we do that? It's usually second year college physics, so it's not something that most of your listeners encounter. But anyway, a string stretched between two fixed points and you pluck it and it vibrates. We have a good physics story to go with how it vibrates based on and as a function of the tension, the density, the mass of the string. We ignore the stiffness of the string, and we ignore the fact that it stretches. I mean, if you pluck it and it goes sideways, it has to stretch because the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. So if it deviates from that straight line, it has to stretch. But the physicists have an insight. I don't like calling it a trick. Physics and math. The amount that string stretches when it moves sideways is, technical terms. If it moves sideways a tiny amount when you pluck it, the amount that it stretches is not tiny. It's teeny weeny.
Right.
Those are technical terms, okay? So we can ignore teeny-weeny compared to tiny. So we're going to focus on the tiny motion up and down of the string when it's a pluck, but the teeny-weeny stretching we'll ignore. And we get away with that. That really works. Okay. And that would be true if both ends are anchored. With the floating bridge, the string goes its full vibrating length. It goes over, it's very snug, going over the bridge, and then it bends. Where it's anchored at the end on the edge of the drum head, it bends down, and that's the break angle as the string goes over the bridge, heads down towards the tailpiece. And what dawned on me was the reason I was having trouble writing physics equations for the motion of a bridge under the influence of the strings in the drum head was that when the bridge moves up and down a tiny amount, the stretch of the string is not teeny-weeny anymore, but it's also tiny. So if you're interested in the bridge moving up and down, it seemed to me at the same time you have to consider the fact that the string is stretching. So instead of a string under constant tension vibrating sideways, you have to think about a string vibrating sideways and the tension getting a little bit bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller while it's vibrating up and down. So then the question was, what's the sound of a string that's vibrating up and down in the ways that strings can vibrate, but also is stretching at least with some something related to the up and down motion. So parts of the up and down motion make it stretch more or less. So there's some stretching going on. The frequency or the tension in the string is getting higher, lower. And, instead of having a fixed pitch, the pitch is kind of warbling up and down. We call frequency modulation. So if you warble it very slowly, that means just kind of except the up and down is happening very fast. So fast that you can't hear it go up and down. Well, I go to Google, okay? I don't know. I stumble on something that a musician, composer, professor of electronic music at Stanford, John Chowning was his name, he stumbled on this I forget now, when it was, and it's in the paper that you have, 1970 or so, or 70s. He had a synthesizer, and it had knobs, an electronic thing, and you could pick a frequency, and it just, if it's a pure sine wave, it sounds kind of boring, kind of like that, right? If the physics thing really sort of bottoms out, I could always get a job as a signal generator. So you have that, but you have another knob which can make that pitch go up and down. Okay, so go, okay, but he could make the up and down go faster and faster because they were knobs and it was an electronic box. And he just, I don't know why, he turned up the speed of the going up and down, the pitch going up and down, until it was going up and down so fast that you couldn't hear it as going up and down because that frequency entered the acoustic range, which is to say roughly 30, 40 times a second. The pitch was going up and down. And he said, whoa, it went from that boring electronic sound, warbling, to something that sounded metallic. That was his word. He patents this as a way to make metallic sounds, and he's at Stanford University, so they own his brain. When you get a job at a university, you like sign away your brain. And what I've read from this music center that he is one of the people who established it, computers, music, sound. Stanford University's second biggest money-making patent ever. They licensed this idea to Yamaha and then do joint R&D research and produce the first generation of consumer electronic musical instruments that when you push a button, instead of sounding like a Moog synthesizer, in the old days they sounded like theremins, kind of... Instead of that, you could push a button and it would sound like something, a flute, a violin, a guitar. So that's the sound of modulating, changing the tension, changing the frequency, while you're playing other notes. And the math of this was known to electrical engineers from radio from the early days. This is called the FM radio.
Well, in fact, we're on FM radio, so...
There you go. There's a carrier frequency, which is just that boring straight one, and then you make it go a little faster, a little slower, a little faster, slower, and that faster, slower is what carries the information of my voice and your voice, and then it gets decoded at the other end. The math was understood. Now, instead of radio waves, where the carrier and the modulation are very, very different frequencies. Now they're in the same ballpark, but there's a basic frequency or a bunch of basic frequencies, and they're being modulated, made a little faster, a little slower. And the net result is this metallic sound.
So now let's hear what Dr. Pollisser is talking about. In a paper on banjo physics, he included sound files to demonstrate his points. This is a pure 587 hertz pluck from a signal generator. And here is the same pluck modulated with a tone of 196 hertz, the kind of modulation produced by string stretching. Yes, this sounds more like a toy electronic piano than a banjo, but as he put it, it begins to account for the characteristic sound of the banjo. In another example, using a real banjo, here's the low string tuned down to F, or 87 hertz, followed by the same pluck modulated by pushing the banjo head up and down. That tremolo frequency is about 6 hertz. Then he speeds it up by 3 times the original sound, and then 6 times. When the modulation is sped up into the acoustic range, the wobble disappears and is replaced by a metallic timbre. Here it is. Thank you. Thus, as he writes, moving the banjo bridge up and down modulates the string's vibrational frequencies by stretching the strings. Now, here's David Pollitzer demonstrating the sound differences between two identical banjos, Deering Good Time open-backed Frailing banjos. Identical in all respects, except the break angle over the floating bridge. As he wrote, they should have sounded the same, and almost did. The first one, fitted with a no-knot tailpiece based on a 19th century style, gave a very small break angle of the strings over the bridge, about 6 degrees. It has what he calls a plunkier sound. And here is the same banjo, but with a Good Time tailpiece with a break angle of 15 degrees. The difference in the sound, he theorizes, is the break angle, which changes the movement of the head and thereby stretches and modulates both the string and the sound. I asked David Pollitzer the question that he originally posed in his own paper. Where does the banjo clang come from?
Yeah. I wish I knew. It has to be the string-drum combination. Because that's the family of banjos, and that's where the banjo ring comes from. So I don't know if you want to distinguish ring from clang. I used clang for this extra thing on the bluegrass banjo, but I think it's related, and I don't know that it's universal. So if a banjo rings, that's in the drum business, and the clang, I'm not there yet. That's a subtlety. Somebody commenting in acoustics, who I respect a lot, a physicist with a lot of sense, he said, you know, trying to really nail the difference between a Stradivarius and a sort of routine violin, that's like, you know, using some light meters to measure the light coming off of a Rembrandt and comparing it to, I don't know, something that you bought at the farmer's market. Are physicists going to be able to put their finger on what the differences are? Well, one thing I know from my course, and I'll circle back in a totally different way. My students, I'm interested in how musical instruments work. By and large, my students, bless them, are interested in how does music work? Because most of them are multi-instrumentalists and they play in youth orchestras, and they're aware that this is a really magical thing, but they're science-oriented. And what's going on here that it has such a hold on us? And we don't know.
Well, let me finish then with this question. To you, what is the beauty of the banjo sound?
Sounds like a banjo. I can't do better than that. I really can't. No, got no words. I am a very lucky man because I get away with, when I pick up a banjo, and I even do it at work, I can tell other people, and I can even tell myself, I'm working. I'm doing research. Come on, that's a good gig, huh?
That's a very good gig.
It is. I'm a lucky man.
David, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
I enjoyed it.
Me too.
You can read Dr. Pulitzer's paper on the banjo and his Nobel acceptance speech online. We'll have links on our website. But here is David playing an old folk song. That is the Perpetual Notion Machine for Thursday, April 30th, 2015. Our thanks to David Pulitzer of Caltech. The Perpetual Notion Machine is produced by a volunteer collective of science enthusiasts every Thursday at this time here on WORT-FM. Next week, we'll take a look at the issue of women in technology. The week after that, May 14th, we will devote the entire show to recruiting new members of our collective. We're looking for new volunteers who would like to produce shows on science. Anyone of any age is welcome. If you're interested, give us a call at 256-2001 or send an email to scienceonwart@gmail.com. That's scienceonwart, W-O-R-T, @gmail.com. Thanks for listening. This is Jim Carrier. Good night.